Cloud cover now, but it'll break up. 39 Racine, 40 Kenosha, 37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow would be the 100th birthday of the great Frank Sinatra. In honor of that occasion, we are replaying a memorable morning show interview from some years ago. Enjoy.
That's Johnny Mercer and Harold Arlen. This man here is gonna take me by the hand, and he's gonna lead me down the right path to righteousness and all that other mother jazz in the right tempo. Fly me to the moon, let me swing among those stars, let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song, let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
That, of course, the unmistakable voice and artistry of the great Frank Sinatra with the Count Basie Orchestra, if I'm not mistaken.
You're not.
And joining us on the morning show today, Professor Sam Chell
from Carthage College, from the English department at Carthage College. But Sam Cello is also a very fine jazz musician, one of the best in the area, and an expert on jazz, and also an expert on Frank Sinatra. And Sam Cello is here on the morning show because I remembered back in the spring that he shared with the Carthage community, although I was not able to be there, a paper that he'd done on Frank Sinatra called Frank Sinatra's Artistry and the Question of Phrasing. And I knew that at some point when our schedules would allow it, that I wanted Professor Sam Chell to join us on the morning show to sort of share some of that same information. And the morning show seemed to be a format where we could also do some sampling of Sinatra's singing. And as it turns out, the timing is impeccable. Sam Chell, at the risk of tooting your own horn, tell us about the news that you got just earlier this week.
Well, the paper, as you mentioned, was a paper that I wrote and submitted to a conference that's held yearly at Hofstra University. Usually it's a conference which is devoted to a very academic, important, high culture kind of subject. And in 1998, they decided to do, because of the man's cultural significance, the Frank Sinatra Conference. And my paper was accepted, and I presented it in November of 1998. They had hoped that Frank would be in attendance at the conference, but he died in May of that year. And I just received word yesterday that the paper had been accepted for a publication in a book that's going to be coming out next year.
Wow. So this conference, I mean, in a given year, it might be more inclined to do something on the string quartet or something.
Well, yeah, right, Shakespeare, the AIDS crisis, those kinds of subjects. So this was a little bit atypical.
So that actually gives us some indication, too, then, of Frank Sinatra's importance, that a conference that has devoted itself in the past to these kind of weighty subjects would deem it appropriate to explore the artistry of someone like Frank Sinatra.
Yes, it was a very unusual conference, very eclectic in terms of the presenters. There were many musicians and composers, and there were historians and sociologists. There were people who were in the business as well as academics, and the same was true of the audience. A number of academics, musicians, artists, but there were also the Bobby Soxers from the 1940s. I've never been to a conference where I gave a paper and someone came up afterwards and asked for my autograph.
So you're famous.
Yeah.
Now let's explore a little bit of your own personal connection to Frank Sinatra. First of all, I assume that you come to this project and other explorations of Frank Sinatra as some sort of fan.
Yes, you might say that. Fan as in fanatic. But I guess I came to Sinatra quite late. There are many ways to approach Sinatra's work, and we have to remember that this man performed in seven decades, beginning with his performance on the Major Bowes Amateur Hour in 1935, and his last concert was in 1995. And one way to approach the Sinatra oeuvre is to look at his recording career. And there are three distinct periods. The Columbia period, when he was the smooth voice matinee idol. And then there's the Capitol period, which many people consider to be vintage Sinatra, his very best recordings. And then he left Capitol and formed his own record company to have greater control of his projects. So I don't see why he could have exerted a whole lot more control than he did under Capitol. And that company was called Reprise. And I came to Sinatra during that period. It was in the early 60s when I heard Sinatra's first collaboration with Count Basie. And from the very opening bars of the first cut, which was Pennies from Heaven, I became an instant fan. I simply had never heard a singer swing that much, perhaps not even an instrumentalist.
Hmm. Now, we're going to concern ourselves almost entirely with matters musical over the next few minutes, but let's talk just a little bit about Frank Sinatra, the man. Do you find your admiration of him as a musician tempered at all by what we know about what Frank Sinatra was like? as a man, as a colleague, as someone mm-hmm. that many people feared and so on. Does that enter in the picture for you at all?
Well, unavoidably, it does. I've always been very much interested in the art of the American popular song, and I've done a number of elder hostels in recent years, and sometimes the students who come to these conferences are hostile when I bring up the name Frank Sinatra. This was quite a shock to me in the early 90s when I started doing programs on American popular song composers, Irving Berlin and the Gershwins and Cole Porter and so on. And then when I would begin to play all the Sinatra songs unavoidably, sometimes people would take some offense, and I became defensive. And I'd soon find that a number of people have trouble getting past the Sinatra persona, the Sinatra biography, his reputation as a womanizer, as an associate of gangsters, and so on. It's never bothered me, and I have to accept many artists, warts and all, and at the same time realize that that becomes in some way expressed in their work. You know, when the Chicago Tribune ran the story on Sinatra's death, it took up the front page of the newspaper, and one of the headlines was the lyric to one of his songs, and the lyric is this: "I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn, and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life." And I think for many of us, it's that resilient side of character that Sinatra is able to manifest in his music, and his ability to keep coming back and to recreate himself, and at the same time maintain a sense of identity, a resiliency that attracts us to him in part.
Right. Well, and it seems to me that he was, if nothing else, he was sort of fearless to the point of being brazen in some ways, in mm-hmm. not pussyfooting around mm-hmm. concerning his life and who he was and who his friends were. I mean, he could have, had he chosen, it seems to me, he could have shrouded some of the more, maybe let's call them, unseemly mm-hmm. sides of his life, shielded them from his public, from his fans, and didn't. I mean, he
absolutely.
There was sort of almost a forthrightness with which he lived out his life, as you say, warts and all.
Absolutely. His music is totally authentic, genuine, honest, truthful. I think that quality always comes through. And he is one artist who is able to sing about the kinds of topics that perhaps many of us would not want to sing about. Loneliness and unrequited love, but not just that, loss and aging and death come up repeatedly in his songs. Last night, as I was trying to pick out among my many recordings some examples for today, I was just struck by the range of emotion and human experience in the music. And I don't think that he could have opened himself up to do such vulnerable material if he didn't have that kind of inner assurance that you're referring to.
Hmm. We're talking with Sam Chell, and we're talking about Frank Sinatra. And Sam Chell, at least in some ways, today on The Morning Show, is representing or giving us at least a taste of a presentation that he made at Carthage earlier in the year called Frank Sinatra's Artistry and the Question of Phrasing. So is that where a lot of this lies, in the gift of phrasing musically and artistically?
Well, it's a question that's always intrigued me, and I guess I'm not the only one. My paper starts with a quotation from Harry Connick Jr., who at one time was considered by many to be possibly the next Sinatra. But Connick Jr. was quoted as follows: "Everyone who listens to Sinatra talks about his phrasing, whether or not they know anything about music." And I've frequently heard people say that that's what they enjoy about Sinatra. So I begin to ask myself, what is phrasing? What do we mean by that? Is it simply his breathing, or is it more complex and subtle than that? And the more I begin to investigate the subject, I found out that it is really quite complex.
Yeah. Does his means of phrasing change profoundly from the early days to the later days?
Not profoundly. He, of course, begins to broaden his range and uses phrasing for more and more expressive purposes. In his early recordings, and perhaps we could just hear a sample of one, his phrasing is very much modeled after the style of his leader and instrumental mentor, who was Tommy Dorsey, a trombone player. Hmm. Dorsey was not a great jazz player, but he had a lovely trombone sound. It was often muted, and seamless legato lines, and it seemed like he would never breathe. And Sinatra would hear Dorsey night after night, and very frequently the arrangements would work that Dorsey would play the song through first, and then Sinatra, the boy singer, would stand up. He'd be seated in front of the band. He'd go to the microphone, and he would try to replicate Dorsey's mode of breathing. And you wonder, good God, when does this guy breathe? He'll go eight bars at times without taking a breath. And the phrasing causes him to push the melody across the bars so that the melody will not end at the cadence or at the end of a four-bar unit. Instead, it's more likely to spill over into the next four bars. And you can hear the Dorsey influence in his early recordings. Now, you asked me if it changes. Yes, it does. Later, we'll see that when he left Dorsey, he began to do things to make the music more personal rather than to allow it to be functional. Dorsey was primarily a dance band.
Hmm. Let's hear some early Frank Sinatra. What do you think would be a good choice to illuminate this this young master of song spinning?
Well, his first hit was 1940, I'll Never Smile Again. But this one is a little bit more convenient. I'll Be Seeing You. Why don't we take a listen to that?
All right. And that was a taste of very early Frank Sinatra, the year 1940, the year of his very first hit. This, of course, was I'll Be Seeing You with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. Mm-hmm. Wonderful example of already a consummate musician at work. It's not fun to hear the Sinatra voice also in its pristine, mm-hmm. youthful prime.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's undeniably a very mellow and pleasant voice. Most Sinatra fans that I talk to don't list that as their favorite Sinatra period. It's almost as though he makes singing sound too easy. It's when the voice begins to get a little bit of grain in it and takes on an almost heroic quality that he attracts the interest of a lot of listeners.
Yeah.
But it depends. Some people like the smooth sound of a Paul Desmond or Stan Getz, and others the somewhat rougher sound of a Coleman Hawkins. I'm now using an analogy to, with a tenor saxophonist. But with Sinatra, you can follow this evolution. In my paper, what I did was take one song, Cole Porter's Night and Day, and I analyzed six different versions of the song, beginning with the Dorsey version, and then the last version that he did with Reprise.
Interesting. And what are the sorts of changes that you can hear if you make comparisons like mm-hmm. that?
Some of them are dramatic changes, and others are very slightly nuanced ones. The difference, for example, between a 1940 and a 1942 recording is very slight. You hear the same tempo and Dorsey trying to establish a beat for the dancers who are doing their foxtrot and so on. But at the same time, you can see that Sinatra is trying to do things within that rigid dance beat. He is trying to make the song more personally expressive of the artist's own experience. Then we get to the later recordings, and some of them are versions which feature a jazz band, the Basie Jazz Band. Others are versions that feature a string orchestra. Some are up-tempo. Some versions are ballad. He did Night and Day with just a guitarist accompanying him as a quiet, intimate, introspective ballad version. And there's another version that he made just with a jazz combo in which he and the vibist Red Norville exchanged improvised scat choruses.
You know what this reminds me of as an opera fan is the fact that you take a great singer like a Maria Callas or a Joan Sutherland or something, and a real opera fan will mm-hmm. will perhaps have 4, 5, 6 different recordings by that
yeah.
one artist doing the same aria,
yeah.
and according to whether or not it's in a studio or live in performance with different conductors, of course it's not quite the same as jazz, but in certain kinds of opera where an artist is free to ornament. In the early bel canto, for instance, or Baroque operas, that will be done very differently, performance to performance, and through the course mm-hmm. of a career, according to what they're physically and vocally capable of doing. That also really changes profoundly. I suppose Frank Sinatra, early on, you touched on the fact that he was capable of feats of breath control
yes, yeah.
that were, you know, I'm sure, sadly, out of reach. By the time you got a little further into his career. But I suppose certain new insights entered the picture mm-hmm. that compensated.
Yeah, that's very true. Early in his career, Sinatra's style was dubbed a bel canto style.
Oh, and, really? I never heard that.
Definitely, yes. And he was a lover of opera. He listened to opera. He studied under Robert Merrill at several points in his career. But as he began to lose some of his chops and some of that breath support, I think it perhaps forced him to pay more attention to the meaning of the lyrics and to the interpretation of the song instead of simply falling back on technique. Hmm. At the same time, I'm amazed at some of the things that he does, even in his last period with Reprise, the album The Concert Sinatra. It seems to me that there are three Sinatra styles. There is Sinatra the swinger, that I referred to earlier when I said my first exposure to Sinatra was with Basie. And then there's Sinatra the torch singer, the saloon singer, the balladeer, someone who makes a personal drama, a Shakespearean soliloquy out of a slow song. And Sinatra slowed songs down to a point that no one had ever taken them before. You can practically walk out between beats and make a sandwich, grab a can of beer, come back before the next beat of the song has appeared. And then the third style is the big, more bombastic Sinatra, the Rodgers and Hammerstein, big Broadway kind of Sinatra. And in the 60s, when he was with Reprise, he did make some of those types of recordings, which draw on all of the resources and physical stamina of the singer. There were a number of times in his career where he realized that he had to get back into shape, and so he would jog and do all sorts of exercises to build his breath back.
Hmm. He was an actor, particularly at certain points in time, and a very gifted actor, and I suppose that had to be something that sort of drained his time away from the process of singing. Do you think his pursuit of acting in any way hurt him, hindered him?
I tend to see them as quite integral, and that's something that I also touch on in my paper. When I talk about his phrasing, I talk about his breath, I talk about the way he handles vowel and consonant sounds, and of course his rhythmic sense. But I also talk about acting theory and the difference between acting in movies and acting on stage. And in movies, we don't necessarily expect the actor to become the role, but we expect the actor to adapt the role to a believable persona. That's what makes John Wayne or Humphrey Bogart or Jimmy Stewart great actors. And Sinatra does very much the same. So we can watch him in everything from On the Town, where he sings and dances with Gene Kelly, to The Manchurian Candidate. And perhaps he doesn't change a lot, but he's still always a credible persona. And the same is true of his music. We accept the authenticity of the lyrics because we accept the authenticity of Frank Sinatra. There's a genuineness about his character that is constant. We know we can trust him. So he becomes our stand-in, our representative. So when he talks about his experiences of joy and of loss, of pain, they're also our experiences.
Let's listen to some more Frank Sinatra. Pull out something that shows him at his best.
Well, let's take a song that he composed, at least in part. He wrote the lyrics to the song, and he's still with Columbia at this point, so I think this will demonstrate some of the evolution of his artistry if you compare this to I'll Be Seeing You. And I'm talking about a song called I'm a Fool to Want You. And this is a cry from the soul. And supposedly Sinatra was very upset about an affair with Ava Gardner, which wasn't going too well at the time.
I'm a fool to want you, to want a love that can't be true, a love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you, such a fool to hold to seek a kiss not mine alone, to share a kiss the devil has known. Time and time again I said I'd leave you, again I went away, but then would come the time when I would need you, and once again these words have to say. Take me back, I love you. Pity me, I need you. I know it's wrong, it must be wrong. But right or wrong, I can't get along without you.
I'm a fool to want you. And that's, of course, Frank Sinatra. And we're joined by Professor Sam Chell, who is a colleague of mine at Carthage College and someone who has followed the career of Frank Sinatra for many, many years, and recently gave a presentation, wrote a paper, Frank Sinatra's Artistry and the Question of Phrasing. And we're kind of talking about that, exploring that, and celebrating it today on The Morning Show. One of the things about that recording that I think really stands out is the fact that as a vocalist who really knew what he was doing, he has all kinds of different colors on his palette, including a nice dynamic range where it remains Frank Sinatra, from soft whisper to nice big full finish. And he has it's though he has all kinds of gears which he can go to do what he wants to do, and he's not limited by technical sorts of imperfections and weaknesses like a lot of other singers are. They've got kind of one shtick they can pull off, and he pulls it off, all of it.
Yeah, many singers probably would have found their careers over at the point when Sinatra made that recording, 1950, I believe, and his career was at its low then. He was no longer the matinee idol, and he was no longer getting movie roles. He wasn't selling records. Columbia was about ready to let him go. But Sinatra had other ideas, and this was just prior to his making a huge comeback and getting an Academy Award as well for his performance in From Here to Eternity. But you mentioned those many gears. Those fascinate me. Sinatra will take the diphthongs, for example, oi, I, ow. And diphthongs are sounds made up of two very rapidly alternating vowels. And Sinatra gets the full value of each vowel in the diphthong. So there's always movement, a dynamic undercurrent in the sound. And his vibrato also seems to be not a constant, predictable vibrato, but at the emotional parts of the song, you'll hear the vibrato interjected. Hmm. And the phrasing, of course, also serves the meaning of the songs. It's that meaning that Sinatra is always trying to illuminate in the song. And so many of the great composers, Harold Arlen, Cole Porter, would say when they heard Sinatra, he got it right.
Mm. There's already a little of that character entering the sound itself in this recording from 1950. I mean, we've already stepped away from what that sound was like in 1940. I mean, it still has much of its beauty, but this sounds more like a man we're listening to rather than a boy,
yes,
in terms of sheer sound.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that's part of the reason that most people prefer the somewhat later to Sinatra to the 1940s popular idol.
Right. Take us further into Frank Sinatra's prime, the capital years, and share with us something else that you want us to hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a period when Sinatra joined up with perhaps his greatest collaborator, Nelson Riddle. And he also worked with Gordon Jenkins. Usually, Nelson Riddle would do the arrangements for the swing albums, and Gordon Jenkins would do the arrangements for the ballads. And Sinatra did something that was quite daring. Most singers, when they released an album in this new long-playing 33 RPM format, would think about having a wide variety of songs, up-tempo, slow songs, and so on. Sinatra was the first person to come up with the idea of doing albums which would be focused on a single theme. They were called concept albums. So produced albums such as Songs for Swinging Lovers, and those were all very upbeat, happy songs. He produced another album called Only the Lonely, a classic ballad album with Sinatra and Gordon Jenkins songs.
What a great title.
Yes, and it's perhaps not an album you want to play when you're feeling somewhat blue. You might want to. Who knows what you might do. It's a very sad album. In fact, Capitol was opposed to Sinatra doing some of these albums because the guy is out there singing about subjects of despair and singing songs sometimes about communities that have fallen apart, and there was a ballpark here that's no longer here. And Capitol just didn't see this kind of album as being successful with the public. But they were very successful, and Sinatra pioneered a new concept here. The albums can be seen not simply as collections of songs, but they can be seen as thematic texts which explore a single theme from many angles.
Right. And that, I'm sure, puts him in stark contrast with a lot of the pop singers of that generation who just didn't think in those kind of profound terms.
There are a lot of great popular singers before Sinatra. Bing Crosby, whom Sinatra put at the top of the list, and most of the singers who influenced Sinatra were women. And when he lists the main influences, that becomes clear: Billie Holiday, Mabel Mercer, and so on. But Sinatra took the popular song out of the territory of the so-called crooner. It's not enough that we simply walk away having a pleasant melody in our mind. He really wants to communicate a deep and affecting experience, to make an intense internal drama out of each song.
Let's hear something from the Capitol years. What do you want to play for us?
Well, why don't we change the pace and play something up-tempo? This is the favorite Sinatra performance of many listeners. It's Cole Porter's I've Got You Under My Skin with the arrangement by Nelson Riddle.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me, so deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well? I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything come what might for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats, repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin.
sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near. In spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Why not use your mentality? Step up, wake up to reality. But each time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop just before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. Yes, I've got you under my skin.
I've got you under my skin, and of course, the great Frank Sinatra on this recording. Professor Sam Chell, the time has flown by so quickly. We have just moments, really, to talk about the later period of Frank Sinatra, the 60s into the 70s, even with a little bit of a retirement in there for a few years, as
That's
I
true.
Recall.
That's true.
And, of course, a career that managed to spin itself all the way into the 90s one way or another.
Very definitely. That's, in many respects, not his best period, and it's the period of some of his inferior work, My Way, New York, New York, the duets albums, and so on. But there was a good side of that, because it did get him a larger audience and fan base. But it's also a period where he recorded a lot of good material as well, and he continued to remain, in my estimate, the curator of the American songbook, the last interpreter of American popular music. We instead now have more emphasis on performance and production, but not on interpretation of a body of material, great musical literature.
You have bells and whistles, you have fancy dancers, and that kind of
right.
thing.
Right. You would never ask the question, what does phrasing mean in terms of Britney Spears or
right.
Ricky Martin? It just doesn't make any sense. It's a commodity we're talking about there,
right.
rather than an artist who is interpreting the text. But there are some real jewels in the later period. And one of my favorites is his reading of Rodgers and Hammerstein's I Have Dreamed from The King and I. And again, it's a Nelson Riddle arrangement.
Wow. And with that, we'll have to draw to the morning close end with sincere thanks to you, Professor Sam Chell, for helping us celebrate the artistry of this great, great singer. And we congratulate you on the success of your paper and its upcoming publication in this new collection. Will that be entitled something overall?
Something. which Sinatra recorded several times, the Beatles song. But I don't think they'll use that as a title.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, at any rate, we're really grateful that you could join us for what I think was a fun and illuminating morning show program. And thanks again for being here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And Professor Chell hastens to have me announce to you that tomorrow night on Saturday Night Bandstand, he is pleased to present an all-new edition of his program in honor of the great Frank Sinatra.
That your arms are lovely, and I have dreamed what a joy you. I have dreamed every word you whisper when you're close to me. How you look in the glow. Like to be loved by you.
it's like to be loved by you. I will love being loved by you.
Again, today's morning show was a rebroadcast of an interview with Sam Chell, at the time a professor of English at Carthage College, and of course now host of our wildly popular Saturday evening program called Saturday Night Bandstand, which begins at 7 o'clock. And again, Sam Chell, tomorrow night will be airing a brand new program he has crafted to honor the 100th birthday of Frank Sinatra. My sincere thanks to Sam Chell for his part in this morning show, one of my all-time favorites. The time now is 8:57. I want to tell you about next week's lineup of morning shows. We have some strong offerings for you. Beginning on Monday, I'm very honored to be speaking with a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Fateh Habci. And Professor Habci is assistant professor of religion at Carthage. He was born and raised in Turkey and is a Muslim. And, of course, there really could not be a more timely topic than for us to examine the religion of Islam and to find out a bit about the Muslim community here in southeastern Wisconsin and what it is like to be Muslim in the United States right now, the political climate being what it is. Professor Habci has been giving some talks at First United Methodist Church about the religion of Islam, and a couple of different people have remarked to me about how very fine those presentations have been. So that is what prompted this invitation, which I'm so delighted Professor Habci accepted. So we will be talking with him on Monday. On Tuesday, President Brian Albrecht from Gateway Technical College pays his monthly visit to the program to talk about the Gateway Foundation. Wednesday, we will preview two outstanding music offerings coming up, not this weekend, but the next. We'll be talking first about the next presentation of the Bell Ensemble in Racine, what sounds like a lovely concert called Christmas in the Court of the Danish King, which is happening on Friday night. And we're also going to preview the upcoming Sing-Along Messiah, which is part of the Fine Arts series at First United Methodist Church. That's Wednesday. On Thursday, you'll hear my conversation with best-selling author Graham Hancock, who really created a stir 20 years ago with the publication of a blockbuster best-selling book called Fingerprints of the Gods, where he set forth the theory that there once was on this planet an advanced civilization which was essentially all but wiped out by the Ice Age, although they left behind small clues to their existence. He's written a follow-up book called Magicians of the Gods. And a week from today, I look forward to welcoming back to the program my good friend Gary Stamm, one of the most highly regarded actors here in southeastern Wisconsin. He's been on the morning show several different times, but on this occasion, it'll be for something quite different. Gary Stamm recently had the pleasure of appearing on the Food Network program Chopped, and his episode is going to be airing